Hi there, everybody. Welcome to the 6th Annual Sustainable Ann Arbor Forum. Thank you very much for coming out this evening. My name is Chip Smith. I'm a city council member here in Ann Arbor representing the 5th Ward, and it's really my pleasure tonight to moderate what I think is a really great program that we've pulled together. And I will take full credit for this idea. And it is because I lack a lot of the technical knowledge to do a lot of the projects that I think that can green our own personal spaces. And so I suggested to Emily Drennan, the energy office, that we have a do-it-yourself night so that we can learn how to take these ideas about solar, about rain gardens, about weatherization, and about growing our own food and teach people how to do these things and at least start to put them in touch with the right resources. So with that in mind, you didn't really come to hear me talk, but I'd like to just take a minute to thank a couple of people. I'd like to thank the city for being committed to this series of annual forum. The next one will be in February, and we'll talk about what that topic is at the end. I'd like to thank Emily Drennan and the staff of the Environmental Office, the Energy Office, the Energy Commission, and the Environmental Commission for being such great supporters, and Emily in particular for pulling together all of the details of this program. And lastly, I'd really like to thank the Ann Arbor District Library for being a partner in this and for hosting this event for us and providing this wonderful facility and helping us get this all taken care of and making us all sound good and look good. So with the thank yous and the formal stuff out of the way, we do have a wonderful program tonight, and we're going to start out with David Levine, the CEO of GeoStellar. And you might think, well, who's this guy and what's GeoStellar? Well, we just came from the Ann Arbor Solar Club kickoff down at Connor O'Neill's, which is a bulk group buy solar program that David's going to tell you about. We're really, really excited about it, and I think the important thing about this program that the GeoStellar is working with us on is that as we look at our climate action plan and what our goals are, we are making no progress towards meeting the goals that we've set for ourselves. And particularly as we look at solar, over the last couple of years, we have averaged about 15 solar installations a year. Oh, 50, sorry, 50. Well, there's not a whole lot of difference between those two numbers. Considering to meet our goal, we need to be averaging 500 annually. So we have a lot, a long way to go with that. And I'm going to let David take over and talk about that program and how you can get involved. And really, the purpose is how can you put solar on your house?
Great. Well, thanks so much for that introduction. How many people were in the previous? Cool. Okay, great. So, no, I'm going to mix it up a little bit and keep it interesting, because the other program was specifically about group solar in Ann Arbor. This is a broader topic and how it works with sustainability. So we're going to make it hopefully a little bit more interesting. Great. So we are calling it the Ann Arbor Solar Club, and we're going to have nice leather jackets that we'll all wear and with, you know, eagles and talons and skulls on them. And our motto is, unironically, go solar with a friend. So the idea of this whole program is to create a culture where it's almost unacceptable to not be green. And it is how it should be, because we have created a culture of where it's growth at all costs, and where, unfortunately, Michigan was one of the states that is going to make it a lot harder for our country and harder for our world to dig ourselves out of the hole that we've dug over the last century. So this really is serious, and this is a city that has an opportunity to really genuinely lead in this transformation. The two gentlemen that are in this picture with me are from the Progressive National Baptist Convention. They are responsible for two of the churches in Washington, D.C. And we're building a program in Washington, D.C. to get solar panels on the properties in the most economically challenged areas. And they have an infrastructure that allows for virtual net metering, which means you could put the solar panels and create the jobs and create the economic benefits south of the Anacostia River and expect and export the power, the energy into Northwest Washington, where Jeff Bezos just bought a $24 million home, and President Obama's going to live while his daughter finishes school and all of that. So there are interesting, creative things that are happening around the country, and I think Ann Arbor is going to find a way to really creatively address the challenge of getting 500 solar panels a year. So it's pretty exciting to be out here. The idea of the program is to make this broad, and the biggest way to do it, the easiest way to do it, is simplicity. Just make it really easy. The other way is to create economic incentives, and that's what I'm going to focus on, because we're trying something brand new. When we mentioned to a company just down the road, Amway in Grand Rapids, what we were doing here and about community solar in general, they started talking about the idea of distributing solar with Amway. And I don't know, in the meeting I had with the Ann Arbor Clean Energy Commission, when I used the A word, I don't remember who it was, but somebody in that meeting said that I needed to read the book Dark Money. And it was pretty interesting. I mean, if you could actually create that kind of momentum and almost crazed obsession that comes from that type of selling and that type of, I know I'm probably offending some people, but, almost that cult-like mentality. I don't know if anybody's worked or even represented for Amway, but there is that monomaniacal focus that there's nothing, if you could translate that to greening up America and to getting energy efficient, then, it might change in spite of what our new administration might be working on. So that's the underpinning of this whole program. I mean, it really is trying to create a genuine community momentum on a lot of different levels, and primarily economic. So I'm going to just skip a couple of the wordier slides. So one thing is just, we do recommend you go to geostellar.com. And there's actually a partnership page, geostellar.com/partners/A2, where when you sign up, you're officially part of the community, but you can also set up as your own sub-community. So if you work for a school, your church, there's actually a way to create your own profile and sign up as your own little group within a group, which you can then either provide additional membership benefits or use it as a fundraiser. And that's the main thing that we want to train. I mean, 5 years ago, I was thinking, when I was a Boy Scout, we sold fertilizer. We sold Scott's fertilizer. Now, apparently, they're all selling popcorn, which, I guess
it's better.
It's
better.
It's better than Girl Scout cookies, I guess.
It tastes better.
But yeah, and it's it's better than weed killer and fertilizer going into the streams. But you still this, I mean, if you could get Boy Scouts, I mean, it could be a combined fundraiser and community service project. Like, there's no reason why this shouldn't just become the basic thing. But we've made it simple so that, you know, you could just carry around your little iPad and become a solar consultant and get your environmental service badge, your electrical engineering award merit badge all at the same time. So that's the kind of creative things we want to see happening that we can't really do as a little company and really require communities for. So all this data gets packaged up into a simple solar profile, one for each house. Each one's different. So you want to look up your own. And there is a lot of science behind this. We have received over $1 million of USDA grants. We've raised $30 million of venture capital and strategic investments. And our belief is that this is just going to be the simple way people are going to go solar. And it's we're like a marketplace. We're like an Uber, an Airbnb, where we connect the local installers and we connect the equipment providers and all the different financing options and make it easy just in a simple app. So the way you go solar is the same whether you use us or you use you go straight to a local installer. The real difference is that we monitor everything centrally. Solar installers are awesome people. But what I found is that when I try and reach one, they're usually on a roof somewhere and might or might not have good reception, and you know, they're running their business. And for me as a homeowner, I would like to know that there's somebody not doing anything else except for watching how my energy's doing. And so we really support all of it long term, and we enjoy it. If you download our app, you can actually push a little button and see all of the installations in your area. And it's just kind of neat. You can see some that go way back, some recent. It says the different types of panels, and you can see what each of them are addressing. Our app is called Solar Mojo, and it's fun to play around on. So download that when you have a chance. So in terms of the equipment, I want to talk a little bit more about the differences. There's solar panels are like computer chips in that they're made of the same material. They're both silicon. What we used to say in college was you can't spell geek without double E. Double E was electrical engineering. You started out by hooking things up. And computer nerds love solar. I mean, it's like digital electricity. Where that comes in is that going solar is not the same as buying a car. It's not about the features. It's not about the sunroof or the Bluetooth or the white wall tires. None of that stuff matters. A watt of power is a watt of power, and it's going to generate a kilowatt hour of electricity. If the sun's shining on one versus another. So why do you get one panel versus another panel? One is aesthetics. That's really a major reason you would get one panel versus another panel. The other important thing is the power density. So when you look up your home and you see immediately that your bill is here, your bill is $350 a month, and you only have the room for a certain number of solar panels, then you can save more money by getting more expensive, more power-dense solar panels. So there we would make a recommendation that you get a premium, you know, a Panasonic 320-watt solar panel, for example, because they are a little bigger, but it's not proportional. So those are the kinds of things that you'll talk through with a solar guide if you wind up doing this. The reason it's important is, and one of the main reasons we came up with this company and came up with this idea, is that we found that over and over, installers were promoting what they had. So in the beginning, it was all power purchase agreements, and those are essentially the subprime, the payday loan of the solar industry, you know, where it looked good. You know, you're just, you don't own the panels, there's no hassle, you just save money on each bill. But the fact is that most of the benefits go to the company that retains ownership of the panels. Then it started being microinverters. And everyone was saying, you know, microinverters are the thing. Well, it was just easier for the installer to have one inverter on each panel rather than doing the aggregation and, you know, a lot more difficulty on the wiring and electronics and all of the, and the training. But now there are centralized inverters that also have panel level optimization. So this was just part of our whole theory, is that if we really made sure that the right, some homes should have microinverters. If they're, you know, and some homes should have centralized inverters with optimizers. You shouldn't have to know that, but going through this whole process, we're going to make sure you get the right ones. The good thing is, right here to kick it off, we've just taken all of the best equipment, and we just said this is the initial offering, so you don't have to worry about it. So the first 90 days, it's all going to be Suniva American-made panels. And I learned today that they're manufactured in Georgia, and then they're assembled in Michigan. Okay, so the partnership program. We didn't talk about this much before, but basically it is very simple. You can register an organization as a partner. You can register as an individual, as a solar pro. You go through training, and then you can actually represent, and there's a compensation plan. If you actually want to become an installer, we are working on job training where you can work with the local installers. You could learn how to do solar design. And there are a lot of different ways to get involved in the industry. But as a solar professional, our idea was when you move into a community, there's a realtor who is probably, you know, the really successful ones were classically the captain of the football team or the head of the cheerleaders, and they know everybody and all that. And then, you know, next in line, there's the insurance agent who's kind of the nerd, but everyone sort of trusted him. And then there's the mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers who are sort of like the party animals, you know, in high school. But anyway, they wound up being the ones who knew everybody and took those jobs. And I just started thinking, okay, well, shouldn't there be a solar professional? Or a lot of them in every community who can actually make these recommendations, who can talk about the financing. Should you do a 12-year loan or a 20-year loan or a 5-year loan or put it on your home equity loan or line of credit? Or is PACE financing available for a commercial building? All of these different questions. So we would like people in this room, if you're passionate about solar, to actually consider becoming a solar professional. So it's a new thing. And you can build a team, and it'll be competitive just like the real estate industry. And someday someone will make a movie like American Beauty, but all about crazy solar professionals. And then we've really won. Okay, so we have all these partners, which gave us this idea where that we could do something national. It was really the World Wildlife Fund who came to us first and said, there are all these community solarized things. Is it possible to do one nationally? And so we came up with a model to do it, and it worked out really well. Probably our most successful, interestingly, was Intuit. And it was because you're dealing with all of these people who are programming personal financial software. And they would type in their address and look at, oh, I can save this amount of money, push button, push button, push button. I don't want to talk to anybody, just go ahead and do it. And it made sense because they understood the tax incentives, and you know, they have Mint.com and they have QuickBooks and all these different things. So we knew we had really gotten something when, you know, all of these Intuit employees were frantically going solar through us. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the professionals and the suppliers. We really want this to be a membership organization as well, where people communicate and support each other on various Facebook groups and email lists. And we're happy to hear about issues that you have. We really want to solve those. And it is all about solar, so it doesn't matter to us. You can still be a member if you installed your solar panels 5 years ago. And we'll even, you know, you can connect up to our app and tell other people about your experience and still get support. So we are going to be introducing a solar card. I don't want to talk about it too much, but it's pretty cool. We soft launched it at the Consumer Electronics Show, where it's really simple. You pay us $250 and you get $300 of electricity. And that's about as simple as you can be. And people understood that. We started talking about it in terms of, you know, in the past, solar was like an intercom. It really only helped your own house. And then in certain areas, it became like local calling, where you could put solar in one place and it would go somewhere else, dissipate within the community, and people could subscribe to it. And we feel like we really invented the idea of long-distance solar, where the economics are so good in this area, I can essentially sponsor all of that and get the benefits on my electricity bill by participating where it's really beneficial. Now, it's never going to be as beneficial as installing your own, but some people can't get credit for a $25,000 installation. So we said, well, why not like the savings bond that, you know, my grandmother gave my daughter when she was born, and, you know, she just cashed in when she went to college because that was what my grandmother told her to do. Well, maybe we'll be giving, you know, these solar cards. We have a guarantee, so you don't have to worry about anything. It covers the workmanship warranty. I'm trying to think if there's, in the last minute... we really do want everybody to join the program, even if you can't go solar. Call us, communicate with us on Twitter, Facebook. We're going to send out emails and let people know. We're going to have an email list for the solar community. And we really, really appreciate the invitation to support this program in Ann Arbor. We really take our work very, very seriously, and you can write to me personally, david.levine@geostellar.com, and I'll make sure that everybody personally is taken care of. So thanks.
Thanks, David. I just want to add how excited the city is to have GeoStellar as a partner. I think, you know, I'm a pretty good representative of somebody that wants to do these things and has no clue technically how to do them. So part of the great allure in having David talk to this group this evening was to say, you know, there is, through GeoStellar, you know, figure out if you can go solar, put you in touch with the installers to do it, figure out how to pay for it, all of that stuff, so that it's enabling us to make personal decisions that will have a broader community benefit. So I think we're all thrilled about that, and I really want to give a lot of thanks to the Energy Commission, in particular Commissioners John Mirsky and Wayne Appleyard and Mark Cleavy, for really spearheading this over the last year. So we're going to move from kind of the high-tech, sexy thing into weatherization. And if you can think of the opposite of sexy, that's probably weatherization.
I'm sorry.
You know, it's insulation and caulk and storm windows. It's not sexy at all. but it gets the most bang for our buck. It's the most important thing to do, and it's the thing that everybody can do. And I think most importantly is as we look at people, low-income individuals, people on fixed incomes, it is the single most important thing that they can do to achieve energy security so that they are not challenged that way. And you know, so I'm not going to say any more about that. I'm going to introduce Aaron Kraft. Aaron, through his work in the Washtenaw County Weatherization Program, has been helping to reduce utility bills of Washtenaw County residents for more than 14 years. As an energy auditor and now program manager for the county's Home Weatherization Assistance Program, he has frontline experience working to make residents' homes more energy efficient, safe, and comfortable. And we're thrilled to have him to talk about weatherization.
Thanks very much. Definitely not sexy, but I hope you're ready because they've got some good nuts and bolts information to share with you. I want to cover a few things in the time I have. A little bit of a background about the Weatherization Assistance Program. A few things that you can think about your own home or friend's home of some basic energy saving things that everybody should be checking on in their own home that are easy to do and have a good payback on the little do-it-yourself kind of things. And then what I like to call a little do-it-yourself building science, where we can look at some tips and tricks to see how your own house is working. So the mission of the Weatherization Assistance Program is to help low-income families receive energy efficiency home improvements. And so obviously making their homes more comfortable, more energy efficient. We focus a lot on health and safety in the work that we do. The program, you probably never heard of it, but it's been around for about 40 years, funded federally. We operate nationwide. In the county, we weatherize about 50 or 60 homes per year. And and the eligibility for the program is income-based for the most part. And so to qualify, you need to be at 200% or below of the federal poverty limit, which you might not realize. For a family of four, twice the poverty limit is about $44,000 a year. A single person, it's about $22,000. So if you're under that limit, you might qualify for the weatherization program. We do all of our work based on a savings to investment ratio. So anything that we do in our program, energy saving wise, has to meet a certain cost criteria. If it doesn't save more money than it costs to do over the course of about 10 years, then it's not usually allowable. So we focus on the really basic things: attic insulation, wall insulation. And then, as I said, some health and safety items where we make sure furnaces and water heaters are operating safely. And we do a whole house comparison. Here's some of the common things that we would cover in the weatherization program. Attic and wall insulation are your two biggest things. If you can think of your home as bad attic insulation or bad wall insulation, those are easy things to tick right off. You're going to save way more money over the next 3 or 4 years if you can afford to do that in your home. We measure every home with a blower door test. So we measure the air tightness of a home and seal it up to a proper level, not too leaky, not too tight. We focus on foundation, basement, crawl space insulation. Oftentimes we find that high efficiency furnaces are a good fit for homes that we serve. We'll take an old energy inefficient furnace and replace it with a high efficiency model. Old refrigerators oftentimes get taken out and replaced as well. At the bottom of the slide, there's a question. Can you guess what's missing from the things that we don't typically do?
LED.
Windows. Somebody said windows. So we don't typically do windows. They just don't have a very good payback period, and I'll talk about that if I have a minute or two at the end. We are starting to do LEDs. Compaq fluorescence, if you mentioned LEDs, we do those too. So now, a couple things that if you can think about your own home or something, someplace where you're parents' home or a friend's home or something, these are a lot of good things. If you can do these things, they're easy to do. A little bit of do-it-yourself here. Your fireplace flue. If you don't have a damper on your fireplace flue, or the damper doesn't fit right, or it's broken or something, that's a really simple thing to stop all that hot air cruising up your chimney all winter long. It's something you don't really see, you don't really feel it, you don't really think about it. Have you ever looked up your fireplace flue? You just got to get down on your hands and knees, look up there. If it's off, misaligned, or not there, you can buy these little inflatable balloon things where you just stuff them up your chimney, inflate them, and it stops all that draft. Hot air rises, as many might know, And so the flu draws all that hot air and just keeps drawing and drawing and drawing it. And so if you can stop that, you'll save a bat. It's hard to fix a damper. That's why I say to get that balloon thing or stuff something up there. The balloon thing is nice because you can inflate it, deflate it if you want to have a fire or whatever. But a lot of things that I've seen over the years. I started as an energy auditor in the program, and so I've done energy audits on a couple hundred homes, probably at least. And a lot of places will have an attic access panel where you go into your attic. You know what I'm talking about? That doesn't fit right, or it's not weather stripped. And hardly any of them are insulated. So if you can think of your own attic access, if you've done air sealing around your attic access, it's covered with a little bit of weather stripping, and there's insulation on top of it, good job. If it's not, it's a huge energy loss because, again, that hot air rises. The hot air is rising up, pressing against the ceiling, trying to get up. The hot air in the wintertime, you get your house nice and warm. If you've got a crack in that attic access or anywhere in your home going on the pressure plane of the ceiling of your residence, that hot air wants to get out because it's rising, it's forcing its way up. So an attic hatch can be a real energy loss. Take a quick example here. Say you've got a little house, 1,000 square foot house, and you're really proud, you've finally insulated the attic and you put it up to R38 and you're just feeling really good about that, but you didn't do anything to your attic access hatch. Say that's maybe 10 square feet at R0, and that's about 1% of the total area of your attic. It drops your effective R value in your attic by 27%. So instead of having R30 up there, you've got an average of R28. So just to illustrate, addressing an attic access, making sure it's insulated and air sealed is really important. And it's kind of easy to do. Here's a couple little slides on what you should do if you have an attic access that you think might not be properly air sealed or insulated. First of all, you want to make it airtight and you want to add insulation. So typically we just put a little bit of weather stripping around the attic access so that when the panel, piece of plywood or piece of drywall, sits on that attic access hatch, it seals tightly. And then you can cut some foam boards or a little bit of fiberglass and attach it to the top of that panel so that it's not only air sealed, it's also insulated. The depth is not terribly important, more is better, but getting any kind of insulation on that panel is a good start. A lot of you may have a staircase that comes down, which is great. You might want to go into the attic, you put stuff up there, whatever. It's really tricky to insulate and air seal around those staircases that accordion down and you put them back up because the stair kind of pops up into the attic, and so how do you insulate over that? Well, you got to build like a box all the way around the staircase and then put the panel on top of that. So it's a little trickier, but it's still really important because you know those doors, you know, if you've got this thing, the door swings down, the ladder comes out, you push the door back up, does it ever fit? It doesn't fit. It's crooked, it's got a big gap there. So all that hot air just cruising up into your attic. So what we typically do in the weatherization program, we'll build a box kind of in the attic, cover it with insulation, and then put a cap on it, cover that with insulation, make sure it's all nice and tight. Helps a lot. Or you can buy something. Just get on the internet, you can find a tool for anything there. You can get a little attic access cover for your staircase. So this one has a little, it looks like a little zipper around it. You can zip it, unzip it, and zip it back up, or you can get big foam ones that are really insulated. And it's a bit easier than kind of creating it yourself. All right, now out of the attic, down into the basement, where you'll find another kind of easy do-it-yourself project is make sure your band joist or your sill box is insulated. This picture is looking at the edge of your home where your joists meet the outside wall. And if that's, we call that the box or the band, we call it the band joist or the box sill. It's an area of the basement that's right adjacent to the outside. So if it's adjacent to the outside wall, it's cold. So we want to insulate that or air seal it by installing sometimes people can use spray foam. That's not quite as much of a do-it-yourself project, but if you can get some foam board, cut it to the size, place it up in there, and then foam or caulk it tight, that's a big, it can help a lot. I'm not gonna bore you with the numbers, but it's really important to do, and not too hard to do. It's easy to access. Sometimes you have an unfinished basement or even in a crawl space. Everybody who's been in their crawl space lately? Good. So if you may know if your band joists are insulated down there. It's the same thing. You don't want your crawl space to be cold. You don't want your basement to be cold, so you can insulate those areas. Let's see here. All right, onto my do-it-yourself building science. So this is a little bit of a different topic here. We're going to look at a few homes, pictures I've taken over the years of areas where you're seeing something weird going on in the house by looking at the roof line and seeing what is going on with this house. Why is there this ring of snow around the outside of the house eaves and no snow on top of the roof? Well, potentially it's because there's a lot of heat, hot air or heat coming through the ceiling of that attic, melting the snow off the roof and leaving all the snow along the edge. It doesn't really tell you what's happening, but it gives you a good clue. Is something going on in that house? Why does this have this little ring around here? Maybe you may wake up in the morning and, well, it may not be happening in your house, but let me, here's a little bit more interesting one. So this is a duplex, and I have a couple guesses. I don't know. I was driving down the street. I saw this. I had to take a picture. So one side of the house is no snow. The other side has all kinds of snow. So think a second. What could be going on there? My guess is that perhaps one of them is occupied at the moment. So the heat's turned way down. There's no heat going into that attic. No air loss or no insulate. No heat loss melting the snow. The other side is they've got it cranked to 72. They're nice and toasty, but they don't realize all this heat is getting into the attic, melting all the snow. The interesting thing is why does the snow melt carry over into the adjacent house at the very top of the roof? Oftentimes those little attic spaces are connected, so it's kind of a weird pattern. Again, it doesn't tell you what's happening in that house. It just tells you there's heat getting into that attic, melting the snow. These two houses are reversed. You can see the house on the left is badly insulated, or there's air leakage at the top of that house. And on the other side, there's air leakage toward the bottom. Both of these houses probably have like a little narrow room up at the top, like a little story. The one's a story and a half, where there's a little room with knee walls and then a small attic at the very top. So if this was your house and you go home and you look and see this snow melt pattern that's really weird, you might want to think about getting an energy audit or having somebody who knows how to, if you can look into your attic and see what kind of shape the attic insulation is in. It might give you a little clue as to something's going on there. Maybe you know my attic is always cold, or there's a lot of cold air coming in. I need to do something about that insulation because now I've got this additional proof that something's going on. And of course, we've got ice dams, icicles. If you see icicles on a home, a lot of times that's because the heat from the house is getting into the attic, melting the snow that's sitting on the roof. Snow melts, turns into water, runs down. When it hits a colder spot, then it freezes again. So icicles don't usually just naturally form. They're because something has melted the snow, turned it back into liquid, runs down, refreezes. The worse the icicles are, the more that house is losing heat and melting more and more snow. It's also how ice dams form. So I'm going to end the night bad-mouthing window replacements, or in my talk anyway. When we do our work, we do a lot of talking to people about why we're not going to replace their windows. And compared to the other work we do, insulating walls and insulating attics, it just doesn't pay to replace windows. So I'm going to skip to one slide here. I know this is smallish print. Hope you can see it a little bit. But anyway, pretend we have a three-bedroom house, and we are going to insulate the attic, insulate the walls. That's going to save us a fair bit of money. My units here will be BTUs per hour. So your house is heated by BTUs, your furnace burns, British thermal units, it heats up the house. If you insulate your walls, you'll save about 12,000 BTUs on this little house. Insulate your attic, you'll save about 5,000 BTUs. If you replace your single pane windows, now I'm saying single pane windows, anybody have actual single pane windows? a couple people, then maybe you want to get rid of those. If you have a single pane window with a storm or a double pane window that's in bad shape, this doesn't apply. So this is the part here, single pane window with storm, maybe it's worth it. Cost you $6,300 to get rid of those windows. If you have actual single pane windows with maybe a storm window, you're only saving 1,200 BTUs per hour at the cost of $6,300. So that it's like two orders of magnitude or so less energy savings than if you were to insulate your attic or your walls. So we're big on insulation in the weatherization program, and but I know windows are great and they make your house look nice, and there's all kinds of other benefits. But from a financial standpoint or an energy saving standpoint, usually it doesn't make sense to do so. So again, sorry to end on a negative window note. If you've just replaced your windows, I'm sure they're very nice. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Aaron, and thanks for not showing pictures of my house, which is so poorly insulated. That just depressed me the whole time. Like most of us in here, I am hardly a climate change denier. I think we can see in Ann Arbor the effects of climate change on us almost every day of every year, particularly as it pertains to stormwater, which I consider perhaps the city of Ann Arbor's greatest challenge. The rainfall and the intensity of our wet weather events has increased so substantially beyond what our infrastructure was designed to handle. This is not just a generational problem, but this is going to be a problem that we continue to struggle with likely for 100 years. We cannot continue to handle stormwater the way that we have in the past. We cannot just build bigger pipes and pump it into the Huron River because it has such a negative impact on the water quality of the Huron River and then of Lake Erie. So we have turned to green infrastructure, and I'm sure everybody in here has heard the term green infrastructure before. And what that is looking to handle things like stormwater in a totally different way. And that's instead of putting every drop of rain and stormwater into a pipe that gets pushed out to the river or to the water treatment plant, it is held in on a site or in a detention pond and allowed to, or just handled as surface runoff and allowed to infiltrate back into the ground. Certainly a challenge with the intensity of rainfall events that we got, but it is green infrastructure is the cornerstone of how we are going to build a resilient community here. Tonight we are very lucky to have with us Roger Moon, and when I asked Roger to send a bio, what he sent me is that the EPA says rain gardens are a functional and appealing site drainage that treats stormwater as a resource rather than a waste product. The way that people landscape can affect how clean our rivers run, you have the power to make these changes. Rain gardens in the home and landscape solve some big environmental problems like being able to eat fish out of and swim in our river. Rain gardens can also solve homeowner problems like water in the basement. It's just one tool in our toolbox of how we deal with stormwater, but it's a very, very important tool. You can hire it out. You can do it yourself for a lot less money. And we are very lucky to have a local master rain gardener, Roger Moon, who's going to take you through the steps, do it yourself, building your own rain garden. Thanks for being here, Roger.
Okay, thank you very much. This topic is not what you'd call sexy, but it does involve dirt. The first question I always get is, what is a rain garden? So the first picture here is two rain gardens. That's what they look like, very nicely done. But I felt I couldn't present that without giving credit to the creatures that make this all possible. So those are also there. I'm going to quickly run through the time allotted. I want to show you some pictures of some local rain gardens and others. I'm going to talk a little bit about how rain gardens contribute to our sustainability as humans, and quickly go through a step-by-step on a DIY building my own rain garden. After that, I'm going to cover some resources that are for your access through the county that would help you if you're interested, should you become interested in doing this. This picture is exaggerated, but it is a anatomical diagram of a rain garden, which is a perennial garden that's in a shallow recess in the landscaping. It's designed to input water from a roof, a driveway, or a street, and absorb it into the ground. It also has a capability for heavier rainfalls to store water. They call that puddling. And should the storm get ever increasing, we don't design anything for the absolute worst. So it does have the ability to safely overflow. And this is a summertime view of a southeast Ann Arbor rain garden off of Platte Road. Eastern Michigan University. I guess this would be in the public domain. Here are four more. The two top ones are good examples of rain gardens because they show how it is nestled into the ground as opposed to a normal perennial garden where you see them typically at ground level or above, and they absolutely have all they do at that level is just require a lot of watering. The lower two are in the public domain, and those are what we call street-side rain gardens. And the lower right, is that photograph was taken on Miller Road in western Ann Arbor. And these operate, they have a curb cut on the street side that allows water to enter there and be absorbed into the ground instead of going down the road eventually into the river. Rain gardens, according to the EPA, are a functional and appealing drainage site for your property, as shown in the diagram there. That rain garden is taking the drainage off the roof and absorbing it into the ground. The water that goes into the ground there takes many years, if it's in Ann Arbor, to reach the Huron River. My house is as the crow flies, it's about a mile away from the river, so that's about 9-10 years for that water to get down there, and when it gets there, it is drinkable. The opposite is the typical street sewer, which is piped directly to the river, and when you're talking about that, you're talking minutes, some cases perhaps an hour or more. So what I'd like to talk about now is why putting that water directly into the river unfiltered is an issue. And I think our friends in Grand Rapids came up with the term hydrofilt, and I think that one word just pretty much sums it up. Water is a great cleanser, as we all know. That's what we use it for. And it all ends up in the street sewer carrying whatever. And the issue we have now is the population and development has grown to the point where just everything is overwhelmed. And you see this in Ann Arbor. Whenever there's a severe storm, even the street sewer can't handle it. It's, you know, coming back up in your lap in the street. So This is the issue which if everybody in Ann Arbor had a rain garden and it took only 10% of the water that comes off their roof of their house, this problem would almost disappear. So let's take the next step and actually create a rain garden. The first step you take, and in this case we're talking about just, for example, taking the water that lands on the roof of your house. The rain gardens are shown in those little blue circles that you see. And they're simply placed in the path that the water is currently taking on the way to its street, on the way to the street. And so it's not rocket science trying to figure out where to place one. Although I will mention it this time, I'm going to mention it again and again, there are people and resources available to help you determine this should you not be able to do it. And sometimes there are complications. So we, unfortunately, when we're, a rain garden is something that is highly functional. It's appealing and beautiful, and it's what nature would like to see, but it does require some calculation, minimal calculation, and that is that the rain garden, if it's going to hold a certain amount of water, you need to know how large it has to be to do that. And the way you do that, the first rule is, you measure the area of the roof that's draining into it. And this is simply done by measuring the length and the width of the walls underneath it. And the county has done the work. We know that in this county, a rain garden size that is in the range of 20% to 30% of the source, this area of the source of the water, is perfectly adequate. So there's a lot of experience behind that number. We'd like to place the garden at least 10 feet from the house. You don't want it next to your foundation wall. We're going to be pretty specific about choosing the right kind of plants. And it's going to be designed to pool water when necessary, but just 3 to 6 inches. And there will be a safe overflow for that. The first step is rain garden area, and there I am. There's a, you see that porch there? It's 165 square feet, and it has a downspout coming off the roof. And it's going to go into a rain garden. It's going to be built in clay. So I picked a number like 28, but I didn't want to hit 30%, so I said, hey, I'll use 28. And came out with a 46-square-foot rain garden. I'm making it circular. That translates into 8 feet in diameter. So I just marked that out on the ground. And now I'm ready to dig. The first step is simply removing the ground cover. The ground cover, yeah, in this case it was sod, so this is just like cutting cake. You just cut it up and pick it up, and there you go.
That only took like 5 minutes to get that far, right?
Yeah, not a little more, maybe six. Okay, I had to level the garden because it's on a slope. It's a 5% slope, so we want to make these garden beds level so we can, when the water comes in, it can spread out and occupy as much area as possible for good absorption. If it's on level ground, you still have to dig, but you don't have to worry about leveling it. Oop, put this button, I'm not used to it. Okay, the leveling is done, and there's something else there. I took the dirt from the leveling process and created a perimeter berm. Because this is on a slope, it needs a berm around the end to hold the water during puddling, and that's why that's done there. But I didn't have to haul the dirt off anywhere. It was right there. The next step, we think we're done, but we're not. We've got to, this is clay, so I've got to churn in some organic material in the bed soil to make a habitable place for the young plants to develop. And then finally, the plants. And you can also use seeds, or you can forget the seeds and let the birds and the wind bring them in. Either way, you'll have them. And I mentioned a safe overflow early on. That's what that slot is there in the berm. So when the during ponding, if the water level gets too high, it has a safe way to escape and go elsewhere other than in your neighbor's foundation wall. Roots, plants. This is the workhorse of rain gardens. The easiest way to get there is using Michigan native species, which are fortunately for us in Ann Arbor. Those are available. There is a native plant nursery here of that name. And you see the scale on this. These are 1 foot increments. So you see those roots are really going down there, and that's how you get the water absorption. If you're using non-natives, some of them have deep roots, many of them do not. And in term for pollinators are very careful about what they eat. They do not like imported plants. I'm guilty of this, I've got a couple myself. And I can watch the bees ignore the imported one and go right to the native. So if you're interested in preserving and feeding and maintaining native pollinators, that's a good way to do it. Finally, I put in what's called an input flow diffuser. It's a fancy name for a bunch of stones that you put down there to basically take some of the energy out of the incoming water. It can be a rush coming in there at times during a heavy rainstorm, so it prevents erosion. And then mulch around the top of the garden. This is a photo if your garden happens to be in full sun. These are some of the favorites. And the palette of plants for full sun is huge. These are all native plants. Some of them are what we call cultivars, which are human manipulated. Some are naturally manipulated. Nature creates its own cultivars. If you want to see evolution in action, just look at plants. In the shade, you think it's all got to be green ferns. No, it isn't. There are native flowering, very, very attractive flowering plants for shaded gardens. Very briefly, this garden took about 16 hours, just not straight. I took a break here and there, and it was about $50. And I took advantage of some of the free services offered by the city. In conclusion, you can become a master rain gardener if you wish. You will learn everything there is to know about this, and there are two classes. There's a classroom version starting February 28th, and if you don't like that one, if you you work during the day and you want to do a noontime online class, that's available this summer. And there are cards you can pick up with that information. And finally, masterraingardener.org. If you go online and dial that up, your information is there for everything that I have said here, plus many, 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 many topics beyond that, everything you need to know. And that's available at your leisure. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Roger. That's really great stuff. I think, rain gardens are such an important part of our strategy for dealing with stormwater, particularly in some of our more challenged neighborhoods. The more that we can do of these, as you mentioned, the better off we are, and I'm glad that we had you to show us how to do it. So our last speaker this evening is perhaps our most distinguished. She has an evening job that you all may be very aware of as the mayor of our neighbor Ypsilanti. But more importantly, she is the founder and executive director of one of the most awesome nonprofits in the state of Michigan, Growing Hope. We went to school at the same time. I happened to go to college with her brother, as I recently learned, and I'm very lucky to have said that close to 20 years now she's been my friend. We are thrilled to have Amanda Edmonds here to talk about how to grow your own food.
Sweet. Thanks. Thanks, Chip. So, 15 minutes is not a lot of time, and you're getting a little tired. It's a little late. All I've had is V8 for dinner so far, so my energy is a little lower than usual, although you may not hear it, but I'm going to talk fast and go through lots of slides. and there's lots of ways to learn to grow your own food. So I'm hoping you leave with kind of inspiration and excitement about what you kind of can do and a couple little tips and basics. And there are so many, plenty of ways, including all of YouTube, to learn more. Got it? How many of you guys already grow your own food? Okay, so like half of you. How many don't want to be able to? Okay, well, we'll see. We'll see when we're done about that. So we like to say, what can you grow in a square at Growing Hope? And I'm going to go very quickly through slides, so you're not going to get a chance to really look for very long. So look fast, don't blink, okay? Growing Hope, we aim to grow healthy people, healthy places, and healthy economies with a core mission around healthy food access and looking at outcomes through all of that. And our work, which I have a little later, is organized around gardens, around youth programs, farmers markets, and economic development. So we're kind of that wraparound food system organization, particularly in the Ypsilanti area. And so a little history lesson, this is the short version of an hour and a half lecture, is that we've been growing our food, especially in urban areas, for a long time, right? And it's not until the last couple generations that we stopped growing our own food. So I'm going to give you a couple history slides really to show you just what we can do and what we have done and hopefully inspire what you can do in small spaces, including urban areas. So in the 1890s, when there was an economic depression in this country, there was what was sort of the vacant lot cultivation era when people were out of work and there was a lot of vacant land. The mayor at the time, Hazen Pingree of Detroit, started a program connecting unemployed people with vacant land. And for every $1 invested, $9 of food was produced for people, for their families, for their neighbors, for sale, etc. What goes around comes around. And then we move into the, actually starting in the same era, the 1890s, into about the 1920s is our first school garden era. And we're so glad Michelle Obama has brought the most recent enthusiasm nationwide to our school garden movements, because people recognize the importance of all of our kids putting their hands in the ground, as of course Janine Palm knows from having little ones put their hands in the ground for many years through her work and her efforts. And so we see just how much food was grown in small spaces. And in fact, in 1914, there was a U.S., there was an Office of Home and School Gardens as part of the U.S. Department of Education, with a goal and a mission out of our federal government that every child in the United States would learn to grow food, because people were urbanizing and losing those basic skills. And interestingly, in World War I, that actually transformed that office into what was called the U.S. School Garden Army, and almost 5 million kids enlisted in helping to grow food for our nation during World War I. And we also look at how much food was grown in World War I, and during our war times, we know popularly people, the federal government put out these campaigns for people to grow in every yard and school and park and place, because in reality, there was a lot of famine already going around in other parts of the world when the U.S. entered the war. So this is what people had to do as their patriotic effort. And it worked. $520 million worth of food by about 5 million gardeners during World War I. And then we fast forward to World War II, and here is a city square in downtown Cleveland. Every place turned around. What was interesting in World War II, and we're almost done with the brief history lesson, World War II is that the federal government was actually hesitant to put out that war garden campaign. What we popularly know from World War II now is the campaign for victory gardens, right? You've heard that of that. Because between World War I and World War II, we had further development and industrialization and also chemicalization of agriculture, and there was a question about efficiency. There was a question of whether people in their own little spots, whatever room they had in their yard or in their workplace or in their school or in a neighborhood park, could really do something and grow enough to make a significant impact. And so it wasn't actually until after Pearl Harbor was bombed that the World War II, the popularly known Victory Garden Movement, started, because people needed a way to dig in and participate. It was, even though this feeling that it wasn't efficient, people needed a way to do something in their homes, something in their communities to support that war effort when they were feeling so helpless at the world and so many family and friends out at war. And in a result, estimates are that U.S. citizens grew, and non-citizens too, people in the United States produced over 42% of the nation's vegetable supply. So That's the lesson learned, that we can do a lot in a small space. You know, food gardening, this is from 2008, because I haven't been able to afford the newest research. It's expensive to buy, but the industry research says that 1 in 2 households actually grow their own food or intend to start. So we have and that is really what's interesting for our work as a food access organization, is that is across pretty equally all income levels. So as I said, our work is around gardening, around farmers markets, youth in schools, economic development, with a core mission around helping people grow and access healthy food and all that builds from there. But what keeps people from doing it? Our own survey from many years ago: time, knowledge, space, etc. So we like to dispel all of those things, that it doesn't have to take a lot of time. It can, if you want, great pastime. Doesn't have to take a lot of money, doesn't have to take a lot of space, and it's a lot more basic than people think. So some of those basics, come on now. I'm waiting. So we like to say, what can you grow in a square? At Growing Hope, we use a 4x4 bed. Can we imagine right now? 4 feet about by 4 feet as a way to bring food growing down to a least common denominator, right? If your memory of gardening is weeding your grandmother's back 40 in the summer times, right? Gardening feels like an overwhelming thing, right? If you rent your home and don't own, and you're not quite sure what your landlord's gonna say, what if we kind of bound it? What if we put it in a container, a raised bed? It looks a little more neat. We can get our head around it. And so it becomes our base unit of measure and communication. Not because raised beds are the only thing, even though we love them for various reasons, and not because that's the only size that you can do, although 4x4 feet is really nice because you can reach in 2 feet on each side and really get to a bed. So it is really a nice base sort of width that uses space fairly efficiently. So what you can grow in a square is a whole lot. Think about how many salads you would get from that bed. These are in shade under walnut trees, which are traditionally hard to grow many vegetables under. And shade is usually not ideal. Most vegetables would prefer 6 to 8 hours of direct sunlight a day. But that's a lot of salad. And when you harvest salad, you are cutting it. And that salad is growing again. So if you think about, what could I do if I could just do 1 4x4 bed of food, you can grow a whole lot. And we actually know specifically how much we can grow because we work with low and no income families. Since 2009, we've helped 350 low and no income families in the Ypsilanti area install 3 4x4 raised beds, bringing beds and filling them with straight compost, and providing coupons for seeds and plants, and giving them support and site visits, etc. And our families weigh and track what they grow, and on average are growing 90 servings of fruits and vegetables. So we calculate it out. You know, poundage is not exciting when you're growing greens, for instance. Dollar value can really vary, but we calculate it all the way through. We know 90 servings of fruits and vegetables with beginning gardeners in only 4 or 5 months of the year. So you can do a lot in only a small space. And you can do a lot in creative spaces. This is an urban farm in Watts, Los Angeles, that some displaced Hispanic farmers grew in the utility corridor that is otherwise unused easement space, and basically are growing, as you see, a whole lot of food in urban Watts. There are so many creative ways, too. This is Community Gardens in Dallas by mostly Southeast Asian refugee and immigrants, using almost entirely reclaimed materials. You don't need fancy stuff to get gardening. And then you can think creatively. In Philadelphia here on the left, this is hydroponic gardening, DIY style, in gutters. Like gutters that you buy from the hardware store, is a whole urban farm on a 1 acre paved lot in downtown Philadelphia. This one here that's in Miami, Florida, was surrounded by, you don't see in this picture, surrounded by cement blocks. So there's lots of ways, and what I'd like for you to think about is not all the fancy stuff is needed to grow a good garden. You don't need cedar, you don't need recycled lumber. It's great, costs a lot, will last longer, but costs a whole lot. It's really quite basic. You can also get into the creative things like here, Growing Power in Milwaukee, which is DIY, all built with regular lumber, hydroponic growing in old recycled pots that then circulates with a whole fish aquaponic system, a whole other system. But there are a lot of ways to grow a lot of small food in urban space, and here is one of the most interesting ones. No longer there. This is a community garden on Michigan Avenue in Wayne, Michigan. You know where Michigan Avenue, right after the Ford plant splits right before you go into downtown Wayne. If you look really closely, there's a high rise there. It's almost all Korean elders, most of whom don't speak any English, and they have the most productive gardens I've ever seen in this state. And these were aquatic gardens in their little retention pond, basically. Those are aquatic community garden plots growing water plants, which is pretty interesting with using whatever space is around to grow food. So, right, the basics, a place to grow, thinking about that. Healthy soil or compost. We are all about organic gardening only because that's what we need to do for all of these reasons. I don't need to sell it. The right plants in the right place at the right time. And of course, the knowledge and support and tools. And then there's the other kind of more advanced. Okay, I'm gonna start my own seeds, right? Gonna get into a little bit more succession planning and growing throughout the season and thinking about extending our season. I maybe have a picture here in the end of our hoop houses at the Growing Hope Center. If you haven't been to our urban farm, come visit, and demonstration gardens to learn about many more of these things. We have a 30 by 96 foot unheated hoop house full of spinach today. That is the most delicious spinach. It tastes like there is sugar on top this time of year. And is that something you could do in a bed or in a cold frame very simply, very cheaply outside right now? You can grow food in Michigan 12 months of the year. You cannot grow tomatoes in January, but you can grow spinach in January and some root crops and some things with really simple methods. And so just some of, again, a few basics. Where are we growing? Where is the sun? How can we do a sun study, i.e. look out the window or look at your site every hour of the day, and is there sun or is there shade, right? 6 to 8 hours of sun, ideal for most, but quite a few greens and other plants like that will do pretty well in the partial sun or shade. They probably like the full sun a little better. How are any buildings relating to where we're gonna grow? So is this building going to provide extra heat, which actually is often an advantage? Is it gonna provide shade? Is there gonna be a lot of water runoff that is good or is bad in the space that am I growing? If I am near a house, am I worried about something like lead contamination, since all of our homes built before the 70s had lead paint on them, for instance? Might I wanna separate a little farther because of that? And there's whole other worlds of that as well. If you need to get a soil test and you have questions about the history of where you're gonna put a garden, you're not gonna really kind of build up, which is one really good reason to do raised beds, if you have questions about that. The hot tip of the night, University of Massachusetts Extension. You can, for $20, do a soil test that includes all basic full heavy metals. And that is the only way you can do that in this country, and it is a hot tip by community gardeners. So you can send a soil sample to MSU Extension, and they will mostly tell you chemical fertilizers to put on, and they'll tell you nutrients. I don't ever test that kind of thing because you just put compost on, because that's how organic gardeners garden. But it is helpful at times to get a soil test for heavy metals, and you can mail it in, print out the sheet, mail it in to University of Massachusetts Extension. Hot tip. Here we keep going. Figuring out about taking up sod. Picking up sod is a lot of work, as you see from other community gardens years ago in Ipsy being built. We don't take up sod where we are when we're building raised bed gardens, which was one of those other benefits. This is actually raised beds built out of the pine paneling I took out of my basement. And they lasted many, many, many years. We take grass, we put down cardboard, we put in compost and build a bed. It is very simple and it is a lot less labor. Soil.
Cold lasagna.
What?
Called lasagna.
Yeah, well, lasagna gardening, especially if we layer up even further. Compost. City of Ann Arbor has excellent compost. You can build beds straight out of their compost without needing soil. Some other places, like we get compost from Tut Hill in Mass, it's too rich actually, and you do need to mix it with sand and some other things. But City of Ann Arbor compost, you can use to build your entire garden beds, and you can download their test results from their contamination, so see what's left in them, and it's pretty good. Thinking about surrounds, again, raised beds, a thing that we love, but not the only way. There's all sorts of creative containers and materials that you can scrap and scrounge and curb find, etc., that do just as well for containers. Tires, we've got swimming pools. We've got building up, like this Chinese community garden in Boston, where we're building structures to grow things on top of and provide shade for onions and greens underneath. That's a common thing in Southeast Asian and East Asian gardens all over the world, and all out of scrounged and scrapped materials, which is pretty incredible. Plants, you following me? I'm going, record speed, right? So Here's the thing. Seedlings are really cheap. People really worried about the cost of the garden and what you need to put money into. And seedlings are cheap and seeds are cheap. And if you're a beginning gardener, get seedlings. A lot of the stuff like tomatoes and peppers and things like that, you really need to get from seedlings unless you grow yourself inside. We have hot weather crops and cold weather crops, things that you can start early and things that you need to wait until a little later in May to put out. Other things are grown from, like, sets is the name of onion, like onion starts. Don't grow onions from seeds. You buy sets. It's like a couple dollars for a couple pounds of onion sets, all that you'll ever need. So start with seedlings if you're a beginning gardener in particular, and think about the right plant, the right place at the right time. Come on now. Is it go? Oh, it's going there, just not going on my screen. Sorry. Cool weather veggies. Cool weather veggies, warm weather veggies, etc. So there are lots of resources online, but that's sort of the main differentiation is things that can do well with the frost and before the frost, not now, right, but before the frost have stopped in about mid-May when it is here, and things that really need to be later. There's your cool weather ones. You can look up cool weather warm ones. There's lots of lists, but that's sort of your main differentiation there. And thinking about things like companion planting, succession planting, where we're thinking about plants that really love each other and plants that really hate each other. Just print out a list somewhere of what likes each other and what doesn't like each other, and your gardens will be a lot happier. And these plants can really build on each other from a June tree and a support and lots of different components. And here's the number one thing, and I'm just about done, is thinking about spacing. Now, there's a delicious 4x4 bed full of chard in our hoop house. Number one thing with beginning gardeners, and honestly, I'm a very experienced advanced master gardener, I still do it, is you put things too closely together. Don't put things too closely together. And use square foot gardening templates, which is still a pretty intensive way to plant, and there's lots of books and online templates and things like that. You can see us working with gardeners of how many go in a square foot. Sometimes seed packets and garden books will now have that, but more commonly they say how many rows. They kind of describe, like, if you have a farm, like, make the rows 2 feet apart and 20 feet long. Well, that's not helpful. So just look up square foot guidelines for small plot gardening, and it's how many you can fit in a square foot. And that's a much easier way to do things. So here's some spacing around square foot gardening. There's books, there's resources, there's plenty of stuff online to lay out what you can fit in that kind of space. Just about done. And there's a lot of cabbage in 4x4 beds. Probably a little too tightly spaced, but think about what you can get out of just that small space. A lot more food out of one 4x4 bed. When we go up vertically is another way to get a lot more food out of a very small space, beans going high. And then we can think about simple ways to extend our season. So while these are kits that we sell at Ypsilanti, which is Growing Hope's nonprofit organic garden supply store in downtown Ypsi, which you should come to, or using row cover or other methods, we can really grow a good chunk of the year. And there's some of our spinach, not this year's, but a couple of years about this same time of the year. So come see us at Growing Hope. If you haven't been there before, we'd love to have you. We rely on volunteers. We do tours and field trips and lots of different things. And then in downtown Ypsi is where we have Ypsilanti, our little retail garden store with all affordable organic garden supplies. We're closed for 4 weeks right now until Valentine's Day. That's where Ypsilanti is, 16 South Washington, downtown Ypsi. And then I really want you to go and learn everything else on our lovely Growing Hope Pinterest pages. All of the resources and ideas you could possibly want in the world, we have curated on our Growing Hope Pinterest pages, and you can follow us otherwise. Thank you, and I know I went 2 minutes over.
Wow. So you know why she went last, because nobody can follow that.
I can pack it in.
That was awesome. We have a little bit of time for a little bit of moderated questions and answers.
So if you have a question, just come to the mic back here and go in.
Wonderful.
Hi. This feels like a silly question, but I got my gardening down to tomatoes and basil and nothing else, because it was just too overwhelming to do more. And now I have deer, chipmunks, groundhogs, squirrels, rabbits, in quantities way beyond 5 years ago. I don't know what accounts for that, other than reproduction.
Okay, so, I hear ya.
So the last 2 years I quit gardening because I don't like to walk out on my porch and see a tomato with a bite out of it. You know, I don't know if there's a simple answer to, you know, other than encasing the garden in, you like the plastic?
Well, I wouldn't do it in plastic. That's really for season extension. We actually sell other kits and tell you how to do it yourselves too. Use the same thing. So this is two pieces, and we bend them and sell them, but we have a bender you can borrow if you want. That's 10-foot metal conduit. That's a $2.50 piece of metal conduit, so $5 on that bed. Bird netting over that. Uh-huh. And then we actually, in the little kits we make, we actually put Velcro down. So grow shorter things and do something like this. But I did this, a version of this for my own tomato staking this year with conduit, where I used conduit and metal conduit elbows and did like 4 foot tall, basically to trellis my tomatoes. You could do the same thing. It's super, and the key is get a piece of 4 foot rebar, not 2 foot. I tried that, didn't work. I always try the cheapest way first. Pound the rebar in next to your beds, whether they're raised or in the ground. Put in, cut some conduit, which you could cut at the hardware store with that cutter there. So like a 4 foot piece of conduit, the little elbow, whatever, like the bed is in down. And you can make yourself a little enclosure that's taller for your taller stuff and put bird netting on it and just use like, whether it's binder clips or something like that, you can have a pretty cheaply enclosed space, which is what people do mostly when they have really big kind of animal issues, unless they want to put a bigger, taller fence around the whole plate or around the whole area, which is not too hard to do with, again, 10-foot metal conduit, you know, in the ground and some deer netting. And because the deer netting or the bird netting, you don't really see it, so it's not a huge visual barrier. It's not the prettiest, but that's what I know people who are really dealing with that do around a bigger space. And the hot tip on that is that because sometimes the deer will decide they want to like trample right through, take an old VHS tape and string it along maybe every foot, and the sound it makes when the wind goes through at a dear friend's house has been a great deer deterrent for her garden, which is wound it that way for a number of years.
Cool.
Hot
tips. All right. Thank you.
For a minute there, I thought that was the question.
Hi, this question is for the gentleman who talked about the weatherization. I live on the west side. I have a single family home. It's a ranch. There's no insulation in the walls, and I don't know if this is a DIY project or not, but I'm fairly ambitious, but I'm not above hiring someone to do some work for me. I'm just wondering if you have any recommendations. The house has aluminum siding. I don't know if that provides any additional help for you.
Sure. So you can, if you're ambitious, you could do it yourself. There's a lot of considerations that you'd want to kind of educate yourself on. It might be, maybe we could talk afterwards, but you can bend that aluminum siding if you can. There's, get one corner of it pulled back, and you can pull it back a little bit, just prop it up with a little stick so that the siding is kind of tilted out. Then you drill some decent sized holes. You have to rent a machine from Home Depot and attach a certain kind of tube to it, and you tube in the cellulose insulation, and it's tricky to blow it in there, especially in a DIY situation, but you can do it. It's even if you hired it out, if you can afford it, it'll pay for itself, like I said. You can do it on the interior too. It's the same thing, drilling holes and blowing it in, but that's way messier, especially if you can pull the siding out.
Okay.
Or if you have plaster. It's really messy if you have plaster.
Yeah, don't do it with plaster.
Hey, Aaron, I have aluminum siding, and I did it many years ago. A contractor did it, and they drilled right through the aluminum, because when I've bent my aluminum up before, it's hard to bend back down. And so they drilled right through, and then I just have little, like, kind of circular caps all along one kind of realm of first floor of my house, and it's fine and great.
Yeah, it's possible, too.
Two questions about the gardening. Is it a healthy idea to plant vegetables in the rain gardens, or would you get poisoned from stuff off the roof?
I mean, I generally wouldn't recommend that's the right place to plant edibles.
Okay. Yeah, typically vegetables do not have the root depth, and they're gone after a year.
Okay.
So rain gardens usually, it's all perennials. You can use trees and bushes as well, but yeah.
And did you plant
they need
flowers
to be
on the berm?
Pardon?
Did you plant flowers on the berm as well?
I didn't. I use, well, if you want to call wild strawberry a flower. I've used a wild strawberry and another plant called Potentilla. Mm-hmm. It's a creeping just a creeping green. But you can use rocks, you can use grass, whatever you want on the berm.
But does, what, how do you have to weed it all the time then? The berm, because if it has no plants on it, you know, weeds are going to, weed seedlings are going to start pretty easy. No?
I haven't noticed a big problem with, the only thing that I've noticed on my berms is if you don't put in edging around the lawn, the grass will tend to creep up there. But other than that, rain gardens don't require much in the way of weeding or any kind of maintenance. In fact, I never even water them except when the plants are new.
I had a question on insulation. I've had to do my house in reverse. I have a geothermal and now tackling the insulation. I see there's a lot I hear from our Canadian neighbors about using Roxul because it has a fire resistance and seems to be mold resistance. But looking at a wall, I've got brick, so I would either have to drill in and look ugly to try to pump it in, or I can try to pull the sheetrock off and put Roxul in to try to get a higher R rating. Any thoughts on versus using Roxul because it also gets a fire rating, or using the spray foam and having someone drill holes and pump it in?
I'm not terribly familiar with that product. Is it, is like a sheet and you lay it in there?
I believe it's spun out of the same stone that we use in gardens to hold moisture.
Okay. Well, that sounds incredibly invasive to take the whole wall off just to put that in. We do drill brick and blow in cellulose insulation from the outside. If you can picture the T where the brick mortar meets, you can get a teeny bit bigger hole there, and you can get like a 3/4-inch nozzle into that hole, big enough that they can blow loose fiber cellulose insulation into the wall. It's even better with, if you can afford to have a foam job done, they'll blow that wall with the foam. It'll go into every little cavity and fill it up real, real nice. It has a great R value. It's pricey. But just because you've got brick, there should be contractors in the area that would be able to tackle that. And they might do it from the inside, might do it from the outside. Depends on what you prefer.
What's the product called again?
Roxul. R-U-X-U-L.
Is it a type of mineral wool?
It's a type of mineral wool, yeah. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of also with that, if someone, I noticed somebody, they had the apprentices insulating my house because they laid it one way and the next one was laid paper out.
Yeah,
paper
yeah.
So they were right 50% of the time. If there is concern of mold by having them put the spray foam in, does it matter? Or
You want to be concerned about that. The spray foam kind of stops the moisture from going through the wall. So if there's, hopefully on either side of the foam, the wall will dry out. If it's had a moisture problem in the past. If there's moisture getting in from above, you want to solve that problem. The foam isn't really going to stop it or make it better or worse or whatever. Wherever the moisture is coming in, if it's moisture in your house, it is creeping through the structure of the wall, it gets stopped by something. Hopefully it would dry out later, but that's not a huge concern, I wouldn't think, with foam.
So it didn't matter that it switches?
Yeah, it's you know,
hello, Walter Schwader speaking. My question is about this as a consideration. To insulate a home, to use solid board insulation simply attached to the outside of the home, obviously building, you know, extensions and windows.
Sure.
But putting something like 2 or 3 inch solid board insulation and then seal it so you have an entire band of insulated foam around the outside of a home. Mm-hmm. As well as putting some on top of the roof.
Yep, that's a kind of an advanced way to insulate a home. You get a much better insulation coverage because you're going insulation continuously across the studs. The studs can conduct cold more easily than the insulation between the studs in your wall. So if you cover those studs, you're cutting off that thermal bridge of the studding. It's a lot of work. I mean, you're putting insulation over the whole home, you're furring it out so that you can then attach your siding to it. It's quite a project, better probably for a big retrofit or a new construction. And then, of course, any insulation you can put on the cap of your home in your attic, whether it's foam board or fiberfill or whatever it is great too.
You know, I had spoken with many, many roofers from all over Detroit. No one would touch insulating the roof on the exterior of the roof.
Oh, sure.
And then I discovered in northern Canada, guess what they do? It's like putting a top on a boiling pot. Makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. All right, hey everyone. I actually have an announcement. My name is Stephen Sherman. If you like conversations like this, I started Ann Arbor Solar and Sustainability Meetup. So if you're interested, we have our next one Wednesday, February 1st from 6:30 to 8. We're still looking for a location, but the best way to stay in touch if you're interested is you go to meetup.com and just search Ann Arbor Solar and Sustainability. Or if you want to talk to me kind of during the Q&A and networking, happy to tell you more about it. But we have all kinds of conversations around solar installations, energy efficiency, energy conservation. Might try and invite out our master rain gardener here, battery electric vehicles, hybrids, anything related to energy worth discussing. We're hoping to cover it there. So once again, Ann Arbor Solar and Sustainability, and that's on meetup.com. Thanks.
And I think that's it for the questions.
Wonderful. You know, let's give our panel a round of applause. They're great.